My name is Roger Smith. This is part two of a two-part interview with Mark Rozelle, a professor of public policy at George Mason University. Rozelle is the author of 9 books and editor of 16 books on various aspects of American government. He has testified before Congress on several occasions on executive privilege issues and has lectured extensively in the U.S. and abroad. Professor Rozelle is also a widely read author. He wrote a book with Mitchell Sullenberger, The President's Czars, Undermining Congress and the Constitution, Studies in Government and Public Policy. It is a paperback. One book description says about your book, sir, faced with crises that would challenge any president, Barack Obama authorized pay czar Kenneth Feinberg to oversee the $20 billion fund for victims of the BP oil spill and to establish and enforce executive pay guidelines for companies that receive $700 billion in federal bailout money. And that position really didn't fit anywhere within the government's constitutional framework. Maybe we need a better word than czar. Maybe the public will accept that. But according to, I guess you can explain the research, but this book shows how under pressure to act on the policy front, modern presidents have increasingly turned to appointed officials, even though that violates the appointments clause and runs into conflict with non-delegation doctrine and the principle. The authors argue that czars have generally not done a good job of making the executive branch bureaucracy more effective and efficient, and whatever utility presidents may see in appointing czars, you and Mr. Sullenberger make a strong case that the overall damage to our constitutional system is great and that this runaway practice has to stop. I'll ask one other question after this. So you've examined the history of it. Did FDR have to appoint czars because of the financial crisis the country was in? And then how did this snowball into a president saying, well, I'm going to bring in my own team?
Yeah. There are various arguments about whether Roosevelt indeed had to go outside the normal system of checks and balances to bring in officials to deal with the financial crisis and also war mobilization. Much of the authority he derived came from precedents that were established in the Wilson administration during World War I. The danger we argue here is that when presidents reach outside constitutional norms and start appointing officials who have policy-making, regulatory, and spending authority, and yet they're not confirmed by the Senate, they're not accountable to Congress.
They're unelected.
They don't fit anywhere into the normal scheme of separation of powers. That creates a real danger to a democratic republic, which is premised on the notion that there are balances of powers among the different branches of the government, and that officials who have spending and regulatory and policymaking authority are directly accountable for their actions. The czars are not. And this process has exploded in recent years, especially in the Obama administration, where there's been a substantial increase in the use of presidential czars in a variety of policy arenas, and a vast increase in the authority that some of these individuals are exercising. So you mentioned Kenneth Feinberg, who is exercising some of the most significant power of anybody in the federal government, and yet, the White House can't even explain clearly where he fits in the governmental scheme of our separation of power system, or who's paying him, or from where his authority derives. So we argue that this is a real constitutional problem. A lot of Americans accept it because they think, well, you've got a czar dealing with a crisis. That means the president's attaching real seriousness to this issue, and this is a more efficient way to get things done. But we make the argument that our governmental system was not founded on the notion of enhancing utility or efficiency. It was based on having democratic accountability and checks on power. And the use of czars works directly against those principles.
And you can't really send out the argument, well, the president appoints his own cabinet, but these are not elected positions, but these are positions of power within the government. So that's really an apples and oranges debate that we're talking about here, correct?
It is an apples and oranges debate because the cabinet officers are Senate confirmed and they have to report back to Congress on programs and spending. And so there is accountability built in. But with czars, presidents are, in effect, circumventing the confirmation process, appointing people to significant positions of power, doing things that in some respects are even more significant and noteworthy than what cabinet secretaries are doing.
Right.
And so we argue that that is a direct violation of constitutional principles, and it has to stop.
Well, we'll see if the public does stand up for it. Hopefully they'll get an active involved in that.
Yes.
Now, turning to our Mason Vos website, we're encouraging students to critically analyze issues in who they're going to be selecting for offices. It would be heartbreaking if they would not even vote or even participate in that critical thinking process. What do you say to a college-age student on the importance not only of voting, but to critically analyze what candidates are offering on their planks and platforms?
Yeah, sometimes it's a hard sell, I have to be honest, and you can see the data to confirm this, that the younger cohorts tend to turn out in much lower numbers than older Americans, and yet young people have such an enormous stake in the future of policies that are being generated these days. Now, the president's campaign, re-election campaign, has tried very hard to mobilize young voters using the student loans issue, for
right.
example, trying to show people there is a tangible difference in your own financial holdings
right.
and in the security of your own financial future, depending upon whether the Democrat or the Republican goes to the White House for the next 4 years. I think that's a smart strategy. Whether it's good policy, I have a different view on the matter. But but it's a good strategy to make clear to younger voters there is a tangible difference to you whether one party or the other wins the White House. And that's the key message that has to get across. Now, 2008 was an aberrational election in the good sense of the word. There was an enormous voter turnout, and young voters turned out in unprecedented numbers in that election
right.
cycle. The challenge we know for the president's reelection campaign is ratcheting up that enthusiasm once again, which I think is really hard for them to do this time.
Mm-hmm. That's what I was going to ask. I think you answered my next question. Which candidate seems to be reaching, communicating to that younger block of voters? I understand each candidate has to appeal to so many different blocks, but concentrating on this younger block, it seems that President Obama had the early lead with the healthcare initiative.
I think that's right. With the healthcare initiative and now with the student loans issue, I think the president has something of an advantage with these younger voters. But keep in mind, the Romney campaign is not giving up on the youth vote at all. They're very aggressive. And I think the Ryan choice as the vice presidential candidate had a lot to do with reaching out to younger voters. The Republican campaign, that is, have to make the case that the fiscal future of this country is going to bear extremely heavily on the younger adult population and younger Americans who will someday become voters in the future. And they have to convince those voters and future voters that the Republican Party is the right place to be right now because the Democrats have not been good custodians of the fiscal well-being of this country. And so if they can convince young people that under a Democratic administration, spending has exploded and the deficit has gotten out of control, and that younger people are going to be paying the bills years down the road, they have the potential to make some inroads with those voters. But I think it's still challenging, and I still give the advantage to the president's reelection campaign because not only the health care and student loans issue are, you know, much more directly or immediately noticeable to young voters, but the social cultural issues are weighing pretty heavily in American politics these days. And what I've really noticed with younger voters is that Democrat or Republican or whatever, or independent, they tend to be socially more libertarian than anything mm-hmm. else. They don't want people in government telling others that you must live by this or that moral code, and my moral code is better than yours or anybody else's. And a lot of young people associate that outlook with the Republican Party, whether fair or not. And so I think that's also going to weigh importantly on this election campaign, that, you know, younger voters, I think, are a bit more in tune with the Democratic Party outlook of social policy liberalism, I suppose you can call it.
I look at it almost at an idealistic point of view, too. They'll see an injustice, and they want to do an effort to try to correct that. Am I on the right track at trying that?
Oh, I think you're absolutely on the right track. This is something deeply held among many younger people. That people should be tolerant and accept different lifestyles. When it comes to issues of personal freedoms or rights for gay and lesbian Americans, for example, you find overwhelmingly the younger voting cohorts, have a let live and let live attitude. Leave people alone. Let them have their lives as they please. Don't regulate moral or social conduct so much. That's not government's role. And the people who really favor more moral control over society and use of government in order to direct a moral or social policy agenda tend to be older voters. Mm-hmm. As they're being replaced by younger voters who are more progressive on social issues, I think that's turning out for the benefit of the Democratic Party over the long run.
Professor Rozelle, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for contributing to Political Thought and helping us critically analyze issues. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Listen for part one of this interview with Mark Rozelle on the Mason Votes webpage.